Again, gonna be first a very quick review. You tell me to what extent you want more details. I'm gonna be pretty fast because this is something that you've seen a million times probably, but I want to make sure everybody's on the same page. Ah, we're gonna start considering multipartite systems. Multipartite systems are four systems that are comprised of two subsystems that are identifiable with their own observables that belong to them. Okay. Now, the description in quantum mechanics of a composite system. Well, if you have two subsystems A and B that can be described individually, and you have Hilbert spaces HA or HB associated with every subsystem, with each of the subsystems, then the Hilbert space of the composite system is the tensor product of these two Hilbert spaces. Now, of course, that means that I can build, and that's to introduce notation, I can build a basis, all right, like that. If this is an orthonormal basis, or subsystem A, and the same with a B, is an orthonormal basis for subsystem B, then the set AI tensor A is, which we also notate as, oh, they're right, two A's. We also notate as AI J. Maybe I'll just write it in terms of the Hilbert spaces. Then this thing is an orthonormal basis. Basis of AB. All right. So yeah, basically what we're saying is, yeah, the description of a system that is a composite system of several subsystems, well, it lives in the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of every individual subsystem. Good. Now, yeah, question?
Just maybe slightly sidetracking in one of the solutions to the information paradox, which is propagated by Subratha and group, what they say is that this is true if you have two subsystems, you can have the whole as a tensor product. But the reverse is not true, where if you have a full system and you try to partition it into two.
Yeah. Oh, indeed. No, it's the arrow. yeah. That's true.
In what cases is the reverse true?
Oh, as the cases, so from our perspective, as long as you can access the information, the observable, so you can talk about the observable, so at least one of the systems separate from the other, then you can partition. So this is about, as we're going to see, I mean, at least from our perspective, this is going to be about what do we call a subsystem? As in, like, can we do a partition of a system into subsystems? Well, as long as it makes sense to talk about the local observables, so the observables of one of the systems, if that thing has a phase space that you can define and have access to at least a sector of, then you can talk about partition. In principle, you just need one of them because you can say, okay, this system and whatever is the rest. You know what I mean? You can always, we will talk a little bit about that because that's related to Steinspring dilation theorem, is the fact that you can always purify. When we talk about entanglement at the end, but at the end of talking about entanglement theory, we're going to talk about Steinspring purification theory, which is that, okay, how do I interpret? So let's get a little bit of interpretation of what entanglement means. Where does entanglement come from? What is the origin of, why do we see entanglement? What do we see thermality? Why do we see ignorance? Why do we need actually to talk about ensembles? Why do we need to talk about density matrices instead of just describing things with states, right? Even if you have full access to the microscopics. When we talk about that, we're going to talk about Steinspring's dilation theorem and a little bit of how do we choose to read that theorem. And I'll mention the church of the larger Hilbert space, et cetera, and then we will have a discussion on that. Of course, many of the things that I telling you, I mean, I'll try to make a distinction. Many of the things that I'm telling you are true for finite dimensional quantum systems or even infinite dimensional but discrete number of dimensions, Hilbert spaces, right? But then when things go infinite dimensional, one needs to be careful with a couple things. I will try to point them out, and that's the key. All right, so this is nothing new. This is something that you know, I assume, from like your basic quantum mechanics, correct? Now, here we have a focus on descriptions of information, right? We talked about the dual interpretation that you can give to a density operator. Density operator could be a representation of an ensemble. That's very easy, right? It's like a collective of many, if you want, identical systems, of which statistically you have a different preparation for each of them. But you could also talk about one system about which you have ignorance. Remember the bag in which you put a white ball and a black ball, and then you pick one, and you want to describe the color of the ball, but you don't know what it is. So for you, the description is a probability distribution, 50-50, right? You can understand both. You can interpret a density operator like that both ways. Now, on Friday, you will do a little bit of a couple exercises on building ensembles and how to interpret ensembles and what is the information that you lose and the information that you keep when you build an ensemble. Now, in that sense, there's something that we really want to be able to do. So how do, imagine that I have a bipartite system in front. I have a bipartite system, but I only have access to one of the subsystems. So say that a bipartite system is in a state OAB. Okay. What is the state Roy and Roby of the subsystem? Right? Very easy to think about this. You have two cars, and that's a bipartite system. Well, you can have a collective state for the two cars, but what is the state of the car number one? That should be easy to define. And that's easy. We know from classical probability theory what happens if you have two random variables, right? And you have a joint probability distribution for the two random variables. If you just look at one of them, what is the probability distribution for one of them? And tell me that. The marginals, right? So we need the marginal probability distribution for the system A. And how do you compute a marginal? Well, you sum, you integrate, depending on what kind of random variable you have, over all possible values of the random variable you're not looking at. Agreed? You erase from the probability distribution the information about one of the variables. That's what we're going to do here. So, row A is going to be the partial trace, the trace over subsystem B of row AB. Of course, write it. Did I call it B? I call it B. In a given basis, you can compute it, of course, summing over the diagonal terms, row AB. Now, how do I understand that? I'll write in a minute. Again, those are things that you've probably seen, all of you. We call that the reduced state of A. Yes, what am I doing when I'm tracing out? Yeah, I'm summing over all possible values of the subsystem B, of any of the all possible eigenstates, if you want, or eigenstates, all possible elements of an orthonormal basis of subsystem B. Now, you may wonder, what does that mean? Because this is an operator. You probably are not wondering, because you've seen this in your quantum mechanics. Just saying, you have an operator that lives in a Hilbert space that is the tensor of A and B. And I'm writing here Brass and Ketz that are only living in HBE, right? So technically, this notation is an abuse of notation. But of course, when I write VI, I mean here identity for A, tensor B, for B. Maybe I should actually write the B here. Makes sense, everybody? When I abuse that, nobody will have any problems with that. Right. This is a problem to have the first time you see quantum mechanics, rather. But I just want to make sure we are all. All right, this we call this operation, we call it partial trace. And this we call the reduced state of subsystem. Okay. Make sense? And so this thing, right? If you want, you can think of it as an operator on Hilbert space. Identity on A is like the identity operator on the Hilbert space of A.
But what you do on B is a vector.
It's okay. I can do a tensor product between a vector and a tensor, right?
Okay.
That is well defined. Make sense, everybody? Yeah. But if you act, so technically, imagine if I have, imagine I'll do an example. Just in case. Imagine that row AB is something like, I don't know, 1 over 3. Then I have 0, 0, 0, 0, plus 0, 1, 0, 1, making it diagonal, plus 1, 1, 1, 1. What do I mean by that? Well, 0, 0 is notation or 0A, tensor, 0B. Read. Read, using this notation. So if I want to do, now the say I'm going to do the partial trace, I want row A, which is the partial trace with respect to B of row AB. And this thing is, let's say this is a two-dimensional system. So this is from n equals 1, 0, sorry, to 1. Then you get n, b. This is, well, I'm going to put the b in here. There, but it's way more comfortable. N, b, and then you have rho a, b here. Technically speaking, this notation sucks. Why? Because that makes no sense. What does it mean to act with a bra that lives in a Hilbert space AB and something that lives in a different Hilbert space that is HAB? This is the tensor of HA and HB. Well, what I mean by this is, well, I'm actually acting on HAB with identity for A, so I do nothing on A, and then I act with the bra and B. Right? That's what I mean with this notation. Make sense? So I do nothing on A. So now it's easy. Let's do one of them. So I have the 0, 0. So this would be a sum of, let's do the first amount, 1 over 3. And then you have, all right, 0, B. You see? Even the notation sucks when you write it. 0, 0, 0, A, 0, B. 0, A, 0, B. 0, B. And you say, okay, what is this? Again, technically, it doesn't make any sense. What is this thing? That's definitely not an inner product. The bracket notation was not designed for that. But of course, it's a slight abuse of notation that is extremely common. What I mean by that is I say, okay, cool. So I act on this state. So I have the state here, 0a, tensor, 0b. And I'm acting with the operator, identity on a, tensor, 0b. And it's very clear this is a contraction. And what I get is, 0a, well, if you want identity acting on, tensor, the 0b, 0b. This is a scalar, after all. So this is a 1, normal basis, and this thing is just 0a. You see what I mean? I did this thing. This thing. It's just, you know, that's the right way to write it, but nobody writes it like that. You write it like this, because why do you want to spend so much energy in your arms? On the other hand, the notation, if not explained, it would bug me. This is incorrect. It's like, technically, what? You define a notation that is consistent, and then you're abusing it. You abuse notation when you actually first apologize for it, and you can abuse it. Make sense, everybody? Yeah.
With regard to interpreting reduced density operators, do you think the distinction between proper and improper mixtures?
I was trying to avoid to get there. Maybe let's go back there at the end. When we finish the first block about entanglement theory, then we go to interpreting improper mixtures versus, because that's actually in the tutorial, there's a question that is related to that. And that's more a foundations question. Because you see, in practice, it makes no difference whatsoever. It's more an interpretation problem. So I want to kind of leave the interpretation for the very end when we are really familiar with how, at least from the informational perspective, want to understand this thing. You're going to get a mixture of the informational perspective and my perspective. Obviously, that's what happens when you get a professor, right? And as it was suggested before, I'm not a very ontic person. So I tend to think about these things, about characterizing the state of information you have, yeah, that you have about the system. Yeah, but we will talk about all that, and we discuss and talk about different perspectives. We'll talk about a couple of interpretations of quantum mechanics that are all are opposite of each other, but also very related. And that's related to how do I interpret this? And the question as to how to interpret these things cannot be answered, in my opinion, alone with knowing about density operators, description of the system. You need to know about measurement as well. That's very important. Because in physics, we believe, or I believe, that the laws of physics should be able to be rewritten only in terms of things that can be measured, only as the outcome of measurements. Otherwise, what are we doing? But I mean, we will be doing something else. If you cannot measure, you don't have falsifiable theory, you don't have science, you don't have physics. So under that principle, then we can try to interpret what is the meaning of this and what are the differences of, and because this is related what you asked, by the way, for those of you who don't know, which I don't know how many, you will see in the tutorial that there are different ensembles that would actually give you the same density operator. And you can interpret those ensembles different and based on how you prepare, how did you reach that state of information? You see, the important thing here is that at some point, you have a state of information about the system. And there are different ways in which you can reach that same state of information. And they look very different when you try to interpret how you got there. Okay, and that's related with improper versus proper. And that we will discuss later. Good question. Definitely very good question. Just I want to avoid it for now. Make sense, everyone? Yeah.
In this case, when we write in the form on the right-hand side, the equation that you've written, if BI was just a basis and not orthogonal, then this form...
This is not a trace, yeah?
Yeah.
That's the problem. So if it's a not an orthonormal basis, then this is not correct. I'm assuming that these are orthonormal bases, yes.
Can we modify that?
Oh, sorry, just the trace. The trace is basis independent.
Yeah.
So I don't care how you write the trace, as long as it's a trace. I just wrote the expression in an orthonormal basis. Makes sense? So, example that I do every day. Well, I could take think of a harmonic oscillator. In a harmonic oscillator, could I do the trace in terms of the coherent states of the harmonic oscillator, which are not orthonormal? Yes, indeed. You need to divide by pi. Things like that. If you have an overcomplete basis, that's not orthonormal. So, of course, you can express the trace in any basis. Only that this is the expression that it takes, some over the diagonals, if you want, the expression that it takes in an orthonormal basis. All right. Everybody on the same page about working with this? Now, typically, if this were a quantum mechanics course, I would go and do examples of how to operate with these things, but I assume that you've done plenty of those, so I'm not going to waste your time on that. If somebody has issues with that, just talk to me. All right. Now, let's begin discussing this thing called entanglement. What is it? How do we interpret it? How was it discovered? Oh, go ahead.
I don't want to prolong that too much, but just when density operators were they introduced for the purpose of describing
ensembles, typically?
But ensembles from which perspective? Like uncertainty in our measurement or?
In the preparation. So typically, it was this thing comes from classical mechanics, if you want. The density operator. It's a, if you want, the quantum expression of the density function in classical mechanics. In classical mechanics, statistical mechanics, when you have uncertainty about the state of a system, right, you have probability distributions over phase space. Rho is kind of that. It would be a funny probability distribution, right, over phase space, not really over phase space. It would be a probability distribution over configuration space, if you want. Now, this connection between the classical mechanics and the quantum mechanics analog is appear actually way later than people using trying to describe ensembles. When people try to describe ensembles for the first time, for example, they're looking at a thermal emission, okay, of something. You have atoms spin up, spin down, and that depends on the temperature that you have. They were trying to describe, okay, this is a thermal source. It has some probability given by Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution of giving me that state and that state if there's a magnetic field, for example. How do I deal with that? Well, in classical mechanics, it's a probability distribution. Okay, but then can we have a probability distribution between these two states? There you go, you get a density matrix. But of course, I think it's kind of, it's nice to know where it comes from, but it's a bit misleading because as everything that we do is only after using it for a while that people truly understand what they're doing. Kind of common in physics. That's what we do all the time. We try to go kick the ball forward, right? And then you have two kinds of physicists, if you want. The mathematical physicists, like Poincaré, and all the people, von Neumann, the people who, and the physicists that are doing the breakthroughs. The physicists that do the breakthroughs are like, okay, I need to go forward. And I don't know either not math, and I don't know if that can be done. That can be an advantage because you can write stupid things that happen to be really genius that a mathematician would have not written, perhaps. But then, you know, there are the people that arrive later on and say, that makes no freaking sense. What are you doing? There's no, well, I have to do it properly. And when they do it properly, is then what we actually understand what's going on. But maybe without that breakthrough, we wouldn't even begin to explain those things, right? So both are okay, both are necessary. I tend to not focus too much on, there's no value, physical value, there's historical value, but not physical value. I'd say why they were introduced in the first, I feel. Make sense? All right. Density operators are the right way of expressing state. Kind of nice, right? From the point of view of symmetries too, because you know that in the postulate of quantum mechanics about states being vectors in a Hilbert space, there's a U1 gauge, if you want. Yeah, state is a physical vector represents a normalized vector represents a physical state except for a phase, global phase, right? You introduced an artificial freedom in there. Well, this gets rid of it. This is more capturing the symmetries, if you want, of describing states in a Hilbert space, and then more. Anyhow, entanglement. So, the EPR argument and Bell inequality. So the EPR argument turns out, this was discussed a lot in the theory, turns out that quantum mechanics, bipartite systems, you can prepare states like this. Let me give you a state vector. Plus, minus. And this. So that those are states, bipartite states that you can build in quantum mechanics. And in fact, they were, even before the 30s, those states were used in atomic physics a lot. You get singlet states, triplet states. Those things appear in your description of quantum mechanics of objects that people were working with in the lab. They could prepare these things. Make sense? Right. And there was the discussion that, well, if we go Copenhagen on these states, Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which, by the way, states that measurements are real and projective measurements are real. You actually modify a system when you measure it, they would say. And you modify it by the projection postulate. We haven't seen it yet. We will see it in the next block. But that little basic bit you've seen in previous courses, of course, obviously. If you measure, you modify the system. The modification, the update of the system after the measurement is take a projector, apply it, renormalize. Right? Well, it doesn't take a lot to realize that if have two subsystems that can in principle be space-like separated, right? If I measure system A and I get a 1 here, the update rule will collapse the state of the system to be 1-1. With probability 1, when you measure B, you're going to get a 1 as well. Make sense? If you apply the update rule associated with projective measurement. Again, let me tell you again, it's a theoretical discussion, but these things existed. People could do these things in the lab. People could prepare these things in the lab and measure these things in the lab when this was discussed. Make sense? Well, there are very interesting discussions between Einstein and Bohr in the Solvay conferences about this. And the discussions are within the realm of what's called philosophy of physics. Now, historical context again. There was this discussion about, okay, what does that even mean? Einstein didn't like, with good reason, Einstein didn't like the idea that you can measure A and instantaneously affect the state of B. So if you do two things, if you are saying that the state is real somehow, it's describing the state of the system, it feels that you would be affecting the state immediately. So either the state is not real, then there are issues here. What's going on? Many people consider that discussion, so Schrödinger and Bohr versus Einstein in the Solvay conference, if you want, the Solvay conference. There was this discussion that was considered purely metaphysical, which is the sense, well, I don't quite care. This shut up and compute, the Griffiths approach, if you want. Shut up and compute and don't care about anything. I don't care. There's no way to distinguish if those things are actually, you know, Einstein would say, well, I believe that perhaps, and we will flesh out this argument at the beginning, perhaps this is expressing, this quantum superposition is just expressing your ignorance, the same way that a probability distribution in phase space in statistical mechanics is just expressing your ignorance. You cannot know the position and the momentum of every molecule here, but just because you don't have a magnifying glass large enough in classical mechanics. That's why you have ignorance, and you have to use probabilistic theories to describe the gas. Einstein thought maybe quantum mechanics is just a fancy probabilistic theory. And really, there are values, real values, that the observables have, that they have, but you ignore. And the quantum superposition is just an expression of it. And you can try to invest it of something else, but maybe this is a, you know, again, there are some hidden variables that you're the same as with a gas, right? There are some variables that are hidden from you, from everybody else, that actually condition the outcome of the measurement. And this is just your ignorance. You got a zero, but it's not probabilistic. It ought to be a zero. You just didn't know. Make sense? That approach and that perspective. Many people consider this discussion irrelevant for practical purposes. Many people, as in like everyone. And it wasn't until one person figured out that you can design an experiment that distinguishes the two cases. And that was big. And that was Bell. And you know what Bell's background was? What do you think? Was a mathematician, a physicist? What was Bell? What was Bell's background? Anybody know? Yeah? Oh my God, no. I would say it's the opposite of a good physicist. I don't know, we can discuss. No. An engineer and a particle physicist share some things, which is, S matrix is kind of flooded with problems, but it works, so I'll use it. It's a formula. Bell was a philosopher of physics. And I'm telling you that because many people underestimate philosophy of physics a lot. Philosophers of physics, typically, your average philosopher of physics know way more math than your average physicist, for example, talking averages. They're closer to mathematical physics than they are to experimental physics, but also they need to factor that in. The amount of knowledge that they have is huge, so don't underestimate them. Just saying. Bell was a philosopher, and Bell was trying to think about, okay, is there any experimental way to distinguish these two scenarios? Having definite values for the outcome of measurements a priori that are inaccessible to you for some magic, or truly, this is intrinsically probabilistic. Right? That makes sense so far? Right. Now, there was an article in 1935. It's funny, right? Because I'm going to explain you modern stuff. But physics was written very differently back in the day, mainly because we have the advantage of having gone on the shoulders of the people who wrote those articles. So when you read those articles, the original sources, keep that in your mind, huh? That these people were doing it when nothing was really understood. So So the way they write reflects that sometimes. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. Again, another historical note. Rosen, very interesting character. But Podolsky, even more interesting. Podolsky is the one that nobody talks much about, but he should talk about more. Podolsky was Russian, and it was funny. It was a Soviet spy, too. And he leaked atomic bomb secrets. Well, it's suspected that he leaked atomic bomb secrets to the Soviet Union as well. And it's funny because there's an interview that, again, you can tell if that interview, you can doubt if that interview is real or not. And then he was asked, oh, why did you do it? Did they threaten your family? Did, you know, is there a reason why you did it? I said, no, it was all fine. I did it. Why did you do it? No, just the money. So it's kind of cool because it reflects some contradictions there. Doing it for the Soviet Union for the money. Anyway, the point being that it's a very interesting character and a great physicist. And I think because he's Russian, he's not really talked about that much. Einstein and Rosen are talked about a lot. Einstein for a good reason. Rosen, of course, all of them have good reason to talk about, but just check him. Don't underestimate Podolsky either. All right. So the EPR argument. There was a paper in 1935 that basically is talking about two options. It's like, well, it puts it out together. There's something that I want from a physical theory. And that's something that I want from a physical theory is the notion of local realism. You probably have seen that in Foundations, I assume. So I'm going to do a very pedestrian. For those of you seen in Foundations, apologies for my pedestrian version of it. Local realism. Local realism consists of two reasonable assumptions about a physical theory, right? Locality and realism. Who can tell me which, maybe somebody who's seen it in Foundation, who can tell me what locality is and what realism is? What's locality? That's the easiest. Yeah.
Okay, sure.
So what's realism then? I don't
that you have some... that there exists a state out there that you can describe with a physical
theory. Realism, you're saying, right? The states and observables exist as elements of physical reality. Very pedestrian, but it works for us. What about locality? What's locality? Anybody? Intuition? If I say something is local, what do I mean? Yeah. That's right. What happens in my lab? Yeah, I'm going to write that. Stays in my lab. What I mean by that is that the outcome of an experiment that I do here, the modifiable, actually, is important. The things that I can control, the knobs and the buttons that I can press in my lab, right, are only influenced by things in my lab. If somebody in Jupiter is doing something, it's not going to change the magnetic field in my lab as I touch it. I dial in the magnetic field. Make sense? It's not very reasonable, though. But in physics, a lot, you do that all the time. You do that all the time even when you can do it. And it, like, sometimes you interpret, you want to give reality. Like, for example, an example that when you cannot do it and we still do it is Feynman diagrams. Feynman diagrams, we often talk about, oh, yeah, what happens is that you have two photons collide that split into an electron-positron virtual pair, right? And they annihilate and, you know, you get scattering, right? We say those things. Even though, of course, it's not real an element of physical reality, even mathematical reality, because that is just a term in a perturbative expansion, right? That is even divergent. So again, we like to do that because it's good for us. It gives us intuition. It allows us to build on things, right? Understand things in terms of things that we can handle with our brains. And locality is also very reasonable, right? It would be very weird if someone does something somewhere else, far from here, and then influences my lecture. Make sense? Also, a little bit at odds with relativity. Because if locality is violated faster than, so between two space-like separated labs, you're in trouble with relativity. Agreed? Makes sense? Everybody happy with these two assumptions? Or what they mean, rather? And these states, if you update, say, that state, if you do a measurement, measure A, obtain measure A, whatever observable this is related to, obtain a zero, then update, and you say that this is update of phi plus minus updated to projection over the zero state A acting on phi plus minus divided by the norm of the projection. Yes. That thing is just 0A, 0B. And now you know with 100% probability that when you measure B, you're going to get a zero. So if you use the PVM update rule, if you carry out a projective measurement and you get a zero, then you're forced to have a zero for B. That is weird. For Einstein, even intuition-wise, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, this thing sounds like spooky action at a distance. You are modifying the system B instantaneously, or very fast, rather. Einstein and Podolsky and Rosen say at the end of the paper, well, we are left with two options. Either realism is violated or locality is violated. In other words, either there is something that we don't know. Quantum mechanics is not a complete theory. Quantum mechanics is a theory of ignorance, effective, that works well. But there's a real theory of which we can get more knowledge about that we don't know anything about yet. There are degrees of freedom there, whatever they are, that if we could access, we could predict outcomes of measurements. It wouldn't be probabilistic. Or the theory is not, well, it could be both, right? But the theory is not local in the sense, or there's something like a spooky action. When somebody touches something in a lab, it will deterministically influence me here. And they say, they don't say one is false. They say it's more reasonable to not be realistic. Make sense? They say more, actually. They actually say there has to be a hidden variable theory that we don't know about. So between spooky action and hidden variable. And you know who actually was right? Was it the Copenhagens? Was Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen? Who was right? Who knows that? Nobody. Which is one of the most interesting cases. If you actually asked me to choose one person to see which one was more right, I would say two people. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen is way more bothersome to violate locality than realism for a physical theory, in my opinion. But this is opinion. Questions, comments before we get to the Bell's, what I consider a nice formulation of Bell inequality violation to show that that quantum mechanics can violate it. Well, local realism, a test of local realism. Questions, comments? Not? Right, let's begin. Not sure if I'll finish today, which is sad. But at least I'll start. Question? I don't think that's true. Don't people know about that? What do you mean by that?
I've just never met someone who doesn't study physics and has dealt with quantum information or foundations. Okay, without the latter restriction, but outside of physics, who knows?
Well, in philosophy, they would know it. Yeah. Oh, no, I mean, they invented it. Oh, what's that?
Is he the same guy from the Bell's paradox?
He is the same guy, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You can tell a philosopher, he's a philosopher, professor of philosophy, undergrad philosophy. Huh? I don't know. I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, I don't know.
Because it is such a big thing.
It is huge, yeah.
In comparison.
And the first experiment didn't happen until 1984. So this thing stayed without an experiment, a suggested experiment without being done for 30 years almost. Huh? just incredible.
I do find it surprising that people outside physics don't really know who Pacquiao is.
This is funny because in the when relativity was special relativity started to be a thing for more than 10 years, many people in physics didn't know who Poincaré was.
Yeah. Okay, for my example of people would rather know Poincaré but not
know. Very strange friends then.
No, I mean people who listen to Brian Cox will not know about that, for sure. I mean like popular science don't get it's rather technical, the difference, right? I mean, in a way, formalizing the difference more than the discussion itself becomes rather technical. So kind of makes sense. Let me set up the problem instead of the, because I think this is the kind of thing that is some math what we're going to go through, and the result is very satisfying. So I prefer to do it in one lecture. But let's set up the problem at the very least, the time we have. So, all right. Consider a system, well, two systems, A and B. Okay. And sets of measurements that yield the outcomes plus or minus one. Okay, so you have two systems, system A, system B. And when you measure A and B, the way that you measure, you could get a plus one or a minus one. Make sense? Maybe you are checking, I don't know, what side of a coin something falls as you experiment, or something that is a bistable system. Quantum mechanics would be measuring a qubit. Make sense? All right. So, the yield outcome when measured locally. So you can think of a Stern-Gerlach experiment, for example, right? You're measuring spin, 1/2 particles, and you have a magnetic field that will deflect in one direction or the other, and that's a measurement that gives you plus one or minus one. Make sense? All right. Let's consider also that the result of a measurement on A will depend on the settings of the experiment which we will call A and possibly a set of hidden variables lambda. So basically we say that we have A is a function of A and lambda. We call A the outcome of the measurement. That would be plus or minus one. You want to write it more properly. Okay. Makes sense what I'm saying? What I'm saying is that I have system A that I'm measuring a quantity A in the system A, and the result of that measurement will be influenced by my settings. That's preparation and the dials in my lab, everything that is controllable by me, but somebody in the lab, and possibly some hidden variables that I know nothing about. Yep. Likewise, for B, we get that B can depend on the settings of the lab B, that's preparation and all the dials and knobs that you can turn, and possibly a set of hidden variables lambda you have no control of. Make sense? All right, so the assumption there's an assumption here. Locality A lambda is certainly not a function of B. That's what I'm saying. I cannot influence the outcome of an experiment on A by controlling the knobs and the preparation on experiment B, lab B, be very far away. Make sense? And then realism. A, B are function of lambda. By that I mean there exists something with definite values that influence my experiment. My settings and the values of this will influence the experiment. Make sense? All right. So as you can tell, this is a problem that is, if you were now tasked to see if there's any way to prove if this is the case in an experiment, it's a tough task indeed. It's not easy at all. I wanted to appreciate how clever Bell's theorem and Bell inequalities are. All right, so people thought that there's no way to distinguish these two until Bell arrived. I'm going to define one thing, and then we're going to discuss until the end of the lecture. We're going to look at the correlators between the measurements, the measurement outcome. Okay, so I'm going to define the correlator AB. This is going to be the sum over all possible values for the hidden variables, because of course I have no control on them, I have full ignorance on them. Okay. And I'm going to even let, in fact, I should have put this here, some kind of a measure, but whatever. I'm going to let the hidden variables be unknown as in a probability distribution. You could say, definite values for the hidden variables, sure, put a delta in here. And that's fine. Same thing. Make sense? So this thing is a probability distribution. So satisfies that. Do we understand what this object is? The subject is the correlator. So is, you got a plus one, I got a minus one. Multiply, I get minus one. That's the correlator. It's the product of the outcomes. If it's plus one, you got the same outcome. If it's minus one, you got the opposite outcome. Make sense? It's a two-point function. It's a correlator. This thing takes values plus one and minus one. And the values that it takes for a given experiment that is carried out is going to be plus one if you got the same outcome, minus one if you got the opposite outcome. Make sense? Question?
Just to the tip, but I think it's important. You also need to assume that the outcome that you get for capital B does not affect the outcome that you get for capital A. Not just the measurement setting, it's also the outcome.
Yeah, that's true, but let's include that in this. You know what I mean? That could be A and B as well. I don't know. That's a post. The outcome is fully determined by this, though. So it's a function of these things as well. That's what you're assuming, unless you want to have retrocausality, and that would be more problematic even.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that includes
It does include signaling in the sense of, for now I could say, imagine two labs that are space-like separated, they cannot signal. But it does include signaling. It does include signaling. Because what I'm assuming here, that basically I'm discarding it. By saying that it cannot depend on A, I'm discarding signaling. You know, if B cannot depend on A, if this signals B with the settings or the outcome, then this thing automatically will start depending on A. You know what I mean? Because the outcome is a function of A. So it induces a dependence.
Right. Well, I would say that A is not a function of capital B.
But if A were a function of capital B, it would be a function of small b. So this is discarded already. So the assumption here is that your experiment as a black box has inputs small a and small b, right? And then gives you values. If you signal the values and somebody does the experiment, then you introduce a dependence on A in here. So that case is certainly included here.
Also, correlator usually, when we define it's in the measurement outcome, here it seems correlator is a function of the settings.
No, this correlator is a function of the measurement outcome. It's indeed the product of the measurement outcomes. You see? It's A times B. So it is the product of the measurement outcomes. But the measurement outcomes depend on A and B. And therefore, the correlator obviously depends. What answer you get when you measure correlations depends on your preparation and what you measure, right? Make sense? But it's a pretty general object. This object is saying, okay, these two things maybe, so they may have a common something, right? Because they both can depend on the set of hidden variables lambda. And I am very general and saying these lambdas could have, it's a probability distribution of whatever probability distribution. I don't even need to know what probability distribution is. Maybe they have a definite value, those hidden variables, and that would be a delta distribution here, but maybe not. Maybe it's probabilistic too. Make sense? So the idea is that with these assumptions that are seem pretty basic, where are they? Yeah, these assumptions that are pretty basic, we're going to be able to prove that this correlator is bounded in a particular way. And that bound, as we're going to take, and we're going to find that bound, when we actually now, okay, now we find about any theory, which is cool, any theory that is local and realistic, as in like satisfying these assumptions, will satisfy a bound in the correlations that you obtain with the theory. And then the next thing that we will do is say, okay, fine, let's do an experiment in quantum mechanics. And let's see if that experiment in quantum mechanics can violate the bound. And this is what we will find. An experiment in quantum mechanics can violate the bound. So there is something about quantum mechanics that we will discuss that makes it a non-local realistic theory. And then one can discuss what that is. Make sense? I don't want to do it today because that takes maybe 20 minutes to go through the math. And I want to do it in one lecture. But that's fine because I readjusted the tutorials to the speed of the course. So there's a new tutorial. Now, you're going to have a tutorial on Friday that is not about this stuff. So it will be the next one. Let's have the last 5 minutes as discussion, questions or comments. You see the, yeah, go ahead.
I guess I was just thinking about, like, you know, this definition of realism, we're assuming there's some hidden variable theory, but you can also be realistic in, like, the Everettian sense, right? What are your thoughts on that sort of?
Hey, then I would tell you to wait until we see measurements, because I'm going to discuss ensemble versus many worlds. Copenhagen versus ensembles versus many worlds. I'm gonna discuss when we get to measurements. And I do have ideas on that. But this is, again, this is discarding this theory of local hidden variable. Well, this would prove that this particular, what I call local realism here, that my definition of realism here is that there are variables that actually have definite values and condition that together with the settings condition the outcome. That's what I'm saying. It's very reasonable from the point of view of if you think classically. Sure, there is something. The outcome of my experiment consists of two things, right? It's determined by two things. Whatever I do in my lab and whatever value things have that I don't have access to. Basically, you can think of it, variables that I have access to in my lab, variables that I don't have access to in my lab, which is what we are assuming here. But if we go to interpretation, I'm going to probably most questions about interpretation, I'm going to tell you to wait until we finish the topic on measurement, because that's really important. When we see the Heisenberg cut, and we see how do we solve the measurement problem? Because the measurement problem is still open, but you can solve it philosophically if you accept one thing or another that cannot be proved, at least of today. So we will talk about that a lot. The one thing is that the Copenhagen interpretation is not an interpretation. Wrong. There are many interpretations that are interpretations. Yeah, go ahead.
I guess another question that I kind of have is with all these bell type scenarios, I get a little confused when we're talking so deeply about locality, but
yep.
Also, like, in some sense, like, traced out the space-time degrees of freedom. So I feel like, because we've traced them out specifically, how can we really say anything about locality?
This is more general. So this is even a good question, very important question. This is actually more general. So if you had the space-time degrees of freedom, what you're saying is a particular kind of locality. What do you call your lab? And then you say, well, I called your lab the causal diamond associated with my experiment, right? That happens in space and time, in some region of space and time. However, this is more general because it is saying, okay, I don't care what it is. Let's assume that you have some notion of locality, and A is what you can control locally. So in a sense, this is more general than that. Now, of course, if you actually tell me you're in space-time and it's relativistic and the causal structure is given by relativity, then that's a particular case of what you mean by this.
Because it just means we should get the same results in like a Galilean space-time.
Oh yeah, for this, yeah, indeed. It's what changes is what you have control of. What are those local preparation variables that you have control on? Yeah.
Then, you know, in a Galilean space-time, you can have, you know, instant propagation, so it's not local in that sense.
Oh, but you could.
Local in this sense, and so I feel like.
But that's the thing. Even in Galilean space-time, you can do an experiment where your lab is very insulated. For example, nobody would actually accept, probably, even before relativity, that if I do an experiment in here and another experiment in Sydney, Australia, whatever they choose to have their knobs on is going to condition the outcome of my experiment. It's very far-fetched. Even in Galilean physics, they would say, okay, is there like some sort of ether? Because one of these values would be what the experimenter decides to do. You know what I mean? The decisions that I make. In order to, okay, my settings are going to be these ones. I'm not going to do it yet, but I already decided it's going to be these ones. And can that affect an experiment on the other side of the solar system, even in Galilean, with a Galilean thought? We know in relativity that, of course not, if you believe in relativity. But even in Galilean physics, that's a very far-fetched thing. You can think of the notion of locality. So, yeah, again, that conditions what you mean by local. But the notion of locality is general. Is, okay, you consider local things that you can control in your lab. Relativity puts bounds to that. But maybe without that, common sense or experimental evidence puts bounds to that. See what I mean? It's more general in that sense, huh?
I mean, I do see your point, but at the same time, if we did live in a Galilean space-time, then those knobs in Australia could affect my experiment because I could send a signal arbitrarily fast.
They could send a signal arbitrarily fast, but then...
I'm only saying that not to be annoying, but just because, like...
No, you're not annoying.
I'm just trying to understand better, like... The portion of locality we have here is different than when we say locality in the relativistic sense.
And I would say more general, because if you are in a relativistic setting, that's a particular meaning to things that I can access in my lab. If you're in another setting, you say, okay, whatever it is that I can access in my lab, I don't care. I have some things that I can access in my lab. It could be a fundamental limit of the theory, or it could be that my lab is in a box completely insulated in Alpha Centauri, and you know, even if it's Galilean, if instantaneous action, it's very far-fetched. It becomes more and more far-fetched that you can affect the system the farther you are, even in Galilean physics, right? Anyways, common sense. What I'm telling you is that the statement is more general. It's not assuming anything about the structure of space-time. It's not that it assumes. So it's bad when you assume one particular structure of space-time. Less powerful if you assume a particular structure of space-time. If you don't, it's more powerful. You're going to prove that as long as you have local variables, then this is true. It could be imposed by the theory, imposed by physical difficulty to transmit information. That's not. People have tested. You know that people have done experiments on this where the choices are made by people playing a video game? That was a thing. At ICFO, they did a Bell experiments where the choices of... Because people in foundations take this thing seriously. For me, there's no point in doing experiments of spooky action anymore. And trying to find the values. Come on, special relativity has been tested to the nausea in these energy levels. So to me, it makes no sense to try to look for a quantum spooky action. But in a foundational level, they don't want to assume anything about the structure of space-time and still do it. You see, so they keep doing these experiments and they keep publishing in PRL. Maybe we have enough of those. I don't know. But the thing is that people still do it in foundations. And in foundations, they did this experiment where it's actually people playing a video game to select what are the initial values of preparation and the knobs. And that's because, okay, how about is maybe the experimenter is affected somehow? You see, we've been like kind of esoterical if you want, but it's foundations. In foundations, you have to consider everything possible. And even if that were possible, if there's a demon that gives you the wrong values and change them when you receive them, if you can have something that is solid under that, you win, foundation. So you try to do it as general as possible. It would be less powerful if you assume a structure. Thales, you want to say something, right? Okay. More questions? Yes, I hope it's going to be the next one. It's going to be a cool lecture if we do that. Because again, you have to put yourself, when you study these things, you have to put yourselves in the mindset of the people who were proposing these things in the first place. When they were like having the Copenhagen interpretation that freaking works, is very practical, works, quote unquote. Gives you recipes that work and explain experiments, and people have an interpretation for that. And then people realize, what do you mean? That cannot make sense. You cannot transmit information faster than light, right? Well, I don't know. But in the end, it's not distinguishable. So what do we care about? And then some philosopher arrives in the 50s and says, well, it is distinguishable. There are experiments that can tell you whether your theory is local realistic. And everybody's like, what? And then people in the 80s, one person and team, right? LaRoche, Cert, and his team, they did an experiment in 1984 where they violated Bell inequality experimentally, many loopholes. The last loophole was closed 5 years ago by doing an experiment with electrons rather than light. It's much easier to have control on dark counts. But it took a while to actually have an experiment that tells you that indeed quantum mechanics is non-local realistic, almost 100%. So this is a big journey, and this has consequences. And when we study entanglement, then the nice thing about this experiment is that if it's not then correlations between hidden variables that we're seeing when we see this entangled state, what is it then? What is entanglement really? What is entanglement? Why is entanglement there, and what does it mean? What is in the theory? What parts of the theory makes entanglement possible? And what does it mean from the point of view of interpretation? How do I interpret entanglement in terms of information correlation? It's so important that when you talk to people that see popular science, many of them still think of the action at a distance. And then you get movies like Interstellar, right? It has a lot of the physics right. Yeah, much numerical simulation, great. But then they talk about love and entanglement. So again, I don't know. You see, popular culture still, they don't get it. It's important that we get it. We can tell them what it is. Make sense? All right, yeah, we're done. It's 15 past. Sorry about that.